Welcome to Gonkcast, an Autechr podcast. I'm Gabe.
I'm Dan.
And we're back from our short holiday break with another bonus episode about your emails. Plus, we'll spend some time with one of the most obscure singles in the Autechr discography, Split Remix 12 from 1999. I want to remind you that our next episode, arriving in just 1 week, will be all about Untilted. We've heard from a lot of you already, but we want all the opinions and hot takes we can get. GonkcastPod@gmail.com, or you can tweet us at GonkcastPod. Contact info is in the show notes of every episode. And hey, while you're there, why not leave us a 5-star rate and review? We'd really appreciate it. Okay, we're definitely going to devote a full episode or two to Autechr's remix work after we finish with the main discography, but we were looking for a little bonus release to pair with this bonus episode, and we landed on Split Remix 12. Dan, what background info do we need to know?
Yeah, like WRRY, Autechr Split Remix 12 is a vinyl-only promo single, but it was even more limited at just 3,000 copies. However, the first track, Autechr Plays Vicensee Against M. Gluck, originally appeared on the 1998 tribute album in homage to Noy. As you might have guessed, the track is a mashup of two songs from Noy's 1972 self-titled LP. In the homage to Noy sleeve notes, Sean and Rob write, the track we sent was not really a cover of Vicensee. We took parts from M. Gluck and Vicensee and merged the tracks. Noy were a little bit like Jeff Mills. We liked them. We chose our favorite track. The B-side, Autechr Play at Drowning in a Sea of Independence, is supposed to be a remix of a track by Bic, but nobody can figure out who this group is or if they actually exist.
One last bit of trivia. This is yet another Autechr release with no specified RPM. In the 2013 Ask Autechr Anything, Sean said that the, quote, Noy remix is 33 to me, but the question remains hotly contested, with some claiming that the B-side needs to be played at 45, even if the A-side is 33. For the record, we've decided to stick with 33 for the entire thing. In regard to reception, Split Remix 12 is not especially well-liked. At a 3.04 on Rate Your Music, it's pretty much tied with the Basscad EP, if that tells you anything. From what I understand, many consider the A-side one of Autechr's finest remixes ever, but I've honestly struggled to find any praise for the B-side or for the release as a whole. So, Dan, what did you think of Split Remix 12?
You know, I like it. It's something kind of very different, I think, in the Autechr canon. I'm a big fan of Krautrock and Noy and stuff. So it's kind of cool to hear Autechr, like a group that's known for doing something like completely different, like sort of, I mean, it's more of a cover than a remix, really, you know, like, I think a remix implies you're like using the actual song and, you know, remixing.
Well, I mean,
it
seems like they are using some of it in a way.
Maybe, but it feels more like samples maybe from the song, but maybe it's just semantics. Who cares? But whatever, it's more of a cover. And it's kind of neat to see like such a, groundbreaking kind of band do something that is a cover, kind of thing. Yeah, exactly. You know, especially, you know, Autechr doesn't like wear their influences on their sleeve or anything,
right.
You know, so it's neat in that respect. But outside of, you know, just the story of it all, like the music itself, I think is pretty cool. It's different than a lot of other Autechr stuff. I think it's like really sort of chill and kind of relaxed even, which is maybe not their sort of typical thing. So it's neat to see them do something different.
Yeah. I mean, it's chill, but it is pretty groovy, pretty funky. Mm-hmm. It's interesting what they do with the tracks. I mean, I've never been very good at identifying like remixes, you know, like what part is coming from where, whatever, but you can clearly hear like kind of the drone from M. Gluck kind of fading in and kind of going deep underneath, but then coming to the fore a little bit here and there. I mean, that track is basically just a drone kind of ambient piece. And then, you know, you've got the like Vicensee kind of groove. It's got like this, you know, the original Noy track is this like nice chug and kind of this like suspended hanging in air kind of feeling, like with these light drones, you know, and these kind of wah-wah like synth, maybe guitar, like mixing in together kind of melodic lines and stuff. It feels like they kind of flip it into something like a little darker, like a little like almost evil, but it's got like this great propulsive but chill funk to it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think what you just said is pretty good. I think they sort of like capture the funkiness and stuff of Vice and C. Like I think the drums, I really love the like bass drum sound that Ottegger used on that. But you know, they capture like the feel of that song, but like the mood of M. Gluck, like the original M. Gluck, it's just sort of like a drone with like these, I assume it's a, you know, like field recording of like a stream or something, you know, water.
Right.
And it's sort of like, you know, a darker track on that self-titled Noi record. Yeah. And so I sort of feel like that is like sort of how they've melded these two tracks together, is like sort of taking the, you know, the funkiness and the feel of Vice and Sia and put it in the mood of M. Gluck.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point. And it's interesting because, you know, when I was listening to like Vice and Sea, I was thinking about how, I don't know, one of the great innovations of Noi and maybe krautrock in general is there's something about this kind of, you know, it's like it's always chugging, you know, but it feels like an ambient piece, you know, because of how consistent the kind of chug is. You know what I mean? You don't think of it really, at least I don't, as like purely rhythmic pieces. Like it always feels like these drifting ambient clouds or something, especially Noi. And I feel like Ottegger does that a lot, you know, where it's like there's a lot of busyness and a lot of percussion, but what you almost feel like you're listening to an ambient track. And I feel like that is kind of what they achieve by, you're right, mixing the vibes of what is essentially a drone track with kind of a chugging krautrock sort of ambient thing. I wanted to, you know, turn to what you mentioned a second ago, which is like Ottegger rarely wears their influences on their sleeves. And it's so funny because we were just talking about this recently, where it's so hard to identify Ottegger's influences clearly because they so, you know, transcend them or like mix them so fully that you can't like really pick little pieces apart. And I found it, you know, pretty weird actually to hear Ottegger, like this is what Ottegger might have been if they let their influences, you know, take the spotlight instead. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's what is sort of neat about it because I mean, you know, we always talk about, you know, you can hear the, you know, hip hop influence, especially on like the earlier records and everything, but it's not like you can never really like point to a specific artist. I feel like, you know, I mean, we've talked about like Mantronix and stuff, but even in that, right. I don't think like, it's not like, oh, you know, that was a Mantronix, you know, trick they just did right there. It's always just like, you could tell like they, you know, have existed in that, you know, like they absorb that world
like completely,
yeah.
You know,
exactly. Which, you know, is one of the best things, but it is really cool, you know, especially this, you know, it's just a 12-inch remix that, like you said, there's only 3,000 copies. You know, I mean, it's meant to only be for like the big fan of Ottegger, you know, kind of thing. Right. So it is kind of neat to see them like do a tribute kind of thing and you know, show that they have this like sort of relationship to krautrock that I think is not like super like evident when you listen to their records, but you know, I think when you hear like this, you can, like you just said, you know, they even in the midst of like ambientness, they always sort of have that like propulsion and everything the way krautrock does.
Yeah,
you know, it's neat. It's sort of like a little you know, key to the you know, puzzle of Ottegger.
Yeah, that's what I found myself kind of settling on when listening to this release, is like, it's cooler to, I don't know, think about Noi as an influence on Ottegger than to actually listen to this track in a weird way. You know, it's just like an interesting, you know, just a rare moment where they open the window and show you how like they develop their sound or something like that. It's so rare that it's really exciting. You know, the track is like fine. And I don't know if this might be a controversial point, but I feel like a great remix, you shouldn't be constantly thinking about the original piece, you know? Whereas when I'm listening to this, I keep thinking like, oh, so this is what they're doing with the other, flipping it, other, like adding a little bit of that one, a little bit of this one. Like, is that wrong of me to, like, I almost want to fault it a little bit for like, if you didn't listen to the Noi tracks, this would just kind of be like a perfectly pleasant background music type of experience.
Yeah, it's hard to say because normally I feel like I You know, I would do it maybe with this because, like I said, I'm a fan of Noi, but I did do it a lot with it, you know, going back and forth listening to Vicency and I'm Gluck and stuff, basically for the podcast, you know. So it's hard to like answer it because I like purposely, you know, force myself to do that. But I think, you know, there's some truth to that. You know, it's the same way, you know, when, you know, a movie or a TV show or something gets like rebooted, you don't want to. You know, like, I guess you want, like, the only way it's worth it is if, like, you get the, you know, sort of essence of the, you know, original thing. But, you know, ultimately, you want something that's, like, wholly new, you know, right. Instead of, you know, watching a remake of, you know, whatever movie, you know, you could just watch the original one unless you're getting something new out of it. So I think there's something, like, to what you said, you know, the remix is sort of the musical reboot.
Yeah, I mean, it's cool. It's a cool track, but I just have this sneaking suspicion that if it wasn't sampling like this iconic krautrock experimental band that everybody loves, it would be kind of like, you know, just a nice little like ditty throwaway kind of a thing.
Yeah,
we haven't talked at all about the B-side, which I think is like less interesting maybe for that reason, you know, that there's nothing to sort of associate it with and hear how they're playing with it. I am firmly on the side of like this Bic group doesn't exist and this is just purely a original Autechre track. You know, it's kind of cool in that it's got like a, like I feel like you can hear a tiny bit of EP7 on the way they do the Noi remix, but here you can like really hear it. I mean, this is the track where I'm like, okay, this kind of does sound like 1999 Autechre a little bit, because it's got like this, I don't know, like this kick, this really deep, like subterranean bass, and this kind of, I don't know, distorted blip. And they all keep happening at the same time. But I almost hear a little bit of that like generative play where they like maybe the kick is like affecting those other two sounds, you know, every time it hits in some like possibly slightly random way. It's kind of neat. It feels like an EP7 track with like very little energy. I understand the impulse to want to say that this should be played at like 45 because it's so long and unchanging. But I don't know. Do you agree with, I guess, consensus that this one is just not nearly as interesting as the first one?
Yeah, definitely. And it might be like you said that it's because, I mean, I'm pretty sure the Bic thing isn't real. I mean, yeah. Nothing, you know, you can't find anything about it. And also, like, they write like Bic, like B-I-C question mark, which I think is a joke on Noi is N-E-U exclamation mark, yeah, you know, I think so. I think it's like a pretty clear joke. But yeah, I think you're right. You know, like the A side of this is interesting in the sense that like you're, you know, seeing some of the, you know, a peek behind the curtain a little bit of Autechre. Whereas this, I mean, I think they're still like trying to do like the krautrocky thing. You know, it's got sort of a, you know, the drums are pretty krautrocky and everything. But you're right. You know, it is like sort of more in the EP7 kind of world. And I think you're right too about the 45 thing. I think people want it to be 45 because it is just sort of so like slow and unchanging, you know, like, yeah, it would give it like a little pep in its step.
Yeah. Well, I think I'm kind of with consensus on this, that it's like an interesting novelty to check out for the hardcore fans, especially the Noi fans. You know, but it's all right as kind of a buried thing. Do you have any reason to say that, no, this is a must hear or something like that?
No, I mean, I think it's clearly just for the fans. I think even Autechre, you know, sort of meant it that way. You know, I mean, obviously, if you're listening to this podcast, you're probably big enough of a fan to check it out. You know,
true.
It's in no way bad. It's just, you know, it's not their most interesting work or most, you know, prescient work or anything.
Yeah. All right, well, we should move on to the emails. We have like a little bit more than usual, so this might be a little bit longer of a bonus episode than usual, just because I think we took a week off. But you want to take the first one, Dan?
Yeah, listener Trond, he says, I think you judge Draft too harshly. Draft is not the kind of resignation that you concluded it to be. It is rather Autechre's attempt to make a virtually physical piece of work and the struggle with the perfectionism that goes into such an undertaking. I sort of see Autechre's sculptors on Draft 730 trying to carve out this dense, massive physical object from mere sound, and from the pile of debris and rejected attempts scattered around the studio floor, still having to settle on the final work presented as a draft because of the immaterial nature of sound itself.
Yeah, I'll read the rest of his email. He gave us an overthink warning at this point. He said, I see draft 730 as Autechre's artificial materialism. Make of that what you will, but I think it would be unfair to dismiss draft as less progressive than the albums leading up to it. The format has been an underlying theme for several of Autechre's albums so far, so is not materialism itself on the meta level of such a theme. You know, I like that. I mean, I find this appealing, the idea of them like working as sculptors, and there is like a real physicality to the sound of draft for sure. But, you know, the more I thought about this, I felt more like, I don't know, if they were sculpting, like, you know, they like imagining like they're starting with some huge block of marble or something, and they're just like chipping away until it becomes something. I feel like it wouldn't sound so densely packed as draft does. I think of it more like, I don't know, a collage. I'm trying to think of another artistic metaphor, but like that they just keep reassembling, or like a cubist painting that they keep cubifying or something like that. And I don't know, I guess my problem here is that, you know how it's called Draft 730, right? Like the 30th revision or something of the seventh album. It may be the 30th revision of the album, but I feel like tracks like, I don't know, Surapair is like the 150th, you know, a revision of that track, whereas like something like Theme of Sudden Roundabout is like the fifth or sixth revision of that track. You know, it becomes like sort of an uneven thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that makes sense. I think you're right. You know, it doesn't mean like all 30 or all tracks were reworked 30 times themselves, you know, just like right. The album as a whole. Yeah, I think that's a good point. And also, I agree with your interpretation of the sculptor thing. It you know, you're sculpting, you're stripping things away, which I think is sort of like
right. The
opposite of, you know, what draft is. I feel like it's so densely packed and everything. I think that metaphor would work better, you know, something more minimal.
Yeah, because I'm like totally on board with an album that is just like endless reassemblings of something. But you can totally hear on some tracks that they kind of like started out as pretty simple bangers and didn't go much farther than that. Whereas other tracks feel like they started out as simple bangers and went like a million miles from that. I mean, it makes for like a sort of disjointed listening experience, even though I like the essential idea. You want to read the next email?
Yeah, listener Lane says, I think draft is fire from start to finish. It stands up to the rhythmic, textural, and cerebral standards that were set on Confield, but the songs are just a tiny bit more straightforward and more inclined to be bangers. I wouldn't say it's fully underrated, but yeah, actually I would. It feels like Autechre were testing the limits of stereo system technology, like they wanted to make the sound as nasty and squashed and roughly textured as possible in a way that's almost perversely pleasurable to my ears. Lane also brought up Pitchfork's review, saying, honestly, I can't even be mad that it got a 6.2, because what was someone in 2003 supposed to make of this? The reviewer says, this music might not lend itself very well to aggressive analysis. I can see where he's coming from, just because the music feels almost impossible to really describe. You don't encounter these noises anywhere in life, and you don't immediately know what emotion to attach to them. But that's the Autechre project. They show you something completely alien and ask you to find pleasure in it without needing a reason why, without the comfort of context.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to, you know, talk about the Pitchfork review a little bit, because it's a 6.2, a pretty harsh pan, honestly. You know, I kind of feel like Autechre is like the Pitchfork breaker, because if you read Pitchfork's Autechre reviews, they're some of the worst reviews in Pitchfork's history, like honestly, as a rule. And this one, however, is really not that bad. And what I kind of appreciate about it is, like, you know, it does keep saying, like, I don't know how to talk about this. And I don't know that it's necessarily because it's a virtue of the album. It's because of, like, what I was just saying, how there are so many different, you know, aspects to this album. It is, like, not really cohesive in any sense. Like, when you read the review, it's like, well, some songs are like this, but other songs are completely different. They're totally like this. And then other songs are even different from that. Like, I don't know, what did you make of their criticisms?
Yeah, you know, I mean, you're right. Like, Autechre and Pitchfork, yeah, have never, you know, gone together well. But I kind of agree with you. They are a little right here. In fact, like, in preparing for that draft episode, it was the hardest one, I thought, like, in making, you know, notes and preparations ahead of time. Like, I was the most, like, worried to talk about it, because sometimes it is, like, really just kind of difficult to speak on that record, you know, because yeah. things, you know, there's not like this cohesion that we find with everything else, you know?
Yeah, it's like, I because anything you could say about it, it's like, you could kind of say the opposite about some of the other tracks.
Exactly.
You know, when I talk about Draft as a whole, and I feel like when people write to us and, you know, wanted to sort of defend Draft, or people who are just big fans of Draft, you know, it's sort of my opinion that what they're talking about is like Xylin Room, IV, Surapair. You know what I mean? Like they're not talking about the whole thing. Like when they're saying like, oh, it's this crazy, densely packed, like totally wild, you know, squashing like stereo, making the roughest sound possible. You know what I'm saying? Like they're just talking about like the highlights, and they're forgetting that there are a bunch of songs that are just kind of like straightforward retreads of earlier Autechre ideas.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, I think we mentioned it on that episode, but I mean the highs on Draft are pretty high, you know. There's some good stuff there, but you're right, there's just too many, you know, lows or even, you know, mediums on that record, you know. It's just especially up until this point, it's just the like least consistently good record, I think.
Yeah, there's just something about the way it starts that makes me feel like it's got this really clear identity, and it's like really different and interesting, like an interesting forward step. But then, like, you know, I throw it on and I'm like, badass. But then once I'm like toward the latter half, I'm just kind of like, oh, I forgot that it's a little all over the place. I want to read another quick comment from Lane, who says, oh, and on the album cover, I anticipate some haters on that front, so I just want to be the voice of reason and say it's good. Yes, it makes you think of the limits of 3D rendering in 2003, but being dated isn't an inherently bad thing. It's not timeless like many of their other covers, but it's still one of the most interesting, and it evokes a sense of boundlessness and extra dimensionality like no other AE cover. I just wanted to read that because I agree. Have you changed your mind at all about the Draft cover, Dan?
No, I still don't love it. And I think when you say something isn't, you know, like being dated isn't an inherently bad thing, I disagree. I think that is a bad thing in art. Like, if something is only good for, you know, a certain amount of time or something, that's not great art.
Yeah, it may become cool in a retro way in a few years. Who knows? All right, next email, listener Colin says, he writes about his initial struggles with Draft and then says, what changed my mind sounds dumb, but I thought it'd be an interesting question for you. Draft first clicked with me when I threw on some headphones and smoked a lot of weed, and since then, I've always considered it their stoner album. For whatever reason, it just has this woody ambience that lends itself to disassociative vibing more than any of their albums. I'd like to also point out its bass-heavy dubbiness, and the relation to dub makes me think of versioning in that genre, which might call back to your discussion on the title being Draft. That's a really good point, actually. That said, I'm curious on your thoughts on drug use and electronic music and how that may or may not relate to Autechre. I feel like they sort of have a reputation as a band for pot smoking introverts, but I've certainly enjoyed all of their music stone cold sober. Does this relate to there being an electronic jam band? I think I read somewhere that Sean and Rob did mushrooms a lot when making Chiastic. Do you think that still or has ever truly had an influence on their music? What do you think about drugs and listening to Autechre?
You know, I'm not the guy to ask. I don't do anything. I don't know. I've never done mushrooms. I don't know. I listen to Autechre stone cold sober basically all the time.
Yeah, me too. I don't partake myself. I mean, it sounds like it would probably be fun, but then on the other hand, there are a lot of Autechre tracks that to me seem like so chaotic
and
like abrasive that I just almost can't imagine being out of my mind a little bit while listening to it.
Yeah, I agree there. You know, a sort of anxiety inducing in that state, maybe.
Yeah. And I feel like for me, part of the, I don't know, one of my favorite parts about Autechre is like the kind of intellectual exercise, like the rigors it runs you through, which is like, I'm listening, I'm trying to understand what the hell is going on. I'm like trying to grab onto things and like understand them and put it all together. So I feel like it would be like much harder to do that if I was, you know, kind of cloudy, right? I would just have to kind of feel it, which has its virtues. But for me, I feel like the more I can like kind of intellectualize an Autechre piece, ironically, the more it actually does hit me in the gut. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I think the existence of this podcast, you know, proves that, like, one of my favorite things about Odd-Tekker is, like, the I can't say the word. You know what I'm trying to say.
Intellectual?
Like, yeah. Like, of their music, you know, like, you know, not to sound like pretentious or you know, the whole IDM thing, but I like thinking about Odd-Tekker, you know, like what went into the, you know, what is the, like, you know, way it was made, you know, what they're getting at with the songs. And you're right, like, any sort of anything like sort of clouding that would just I think make me enjoy it less.
Yeah, I do love the point though about versioning. I feel like that actually is really,
yeah, I didn't think about that. Yeah, that is
it. Does have a kind of dubby, like, bass heavy quality, and a lot of the tracks actually do kind of just, like, you know, like these dub versions, they don't necessarily go anywhere. They just kind of, like, open up and drift away, you know. And it's kind of like, there are a lot of tracks that we were sort of critical of on Draft because all they do is, like, slowly fall apart and don't arrive at any destination. But I guess if you're in, like, a dubby headspace, that's might actually be exactly what you're after. You want to read the next one?
Yeah, listener Andy, they say, I think there are two main ways to listen to Odd-Tekker, and they both result in two completely different experiences. The first is to imagine Rob and Sean are performing this live. You imagine what kind of gear they use, the decisions made around the album's vibe, the kind of plugins they use to create certain effects and samples that sound almost like real-life things. This method of listening is more focused on Rob and Sean as performers and their evolution through each album. Then there's the second way, probably the way Odd-Tekker wants to listen to each album, which is to mentally disconnect the idea of performance and just listen to the soundscape that is presented. It's kind of like Musique Concrète and the other early forms of electronic music, where you have to partially turn your brain off and not think about the source of the sound, but rather the emotional effect each sound gives off. For example, it may sound like Rob and Sean are sampling Woodblocks, but what is the emotional effect of that? What is the story they're telling, and what sonic universe are they conveying? This method of listening is less about performance and more about the album itself and what it represents.
Yeah, I agree with this, like, 99%. I feel like I when I listen to Odd-Tekker, I do kind of, like, oscillate between these two things, where sometimes I'm thinking of them as, like, these scientists in a laboratory. Like, how did they do that? You know, what were they doing? Like, what are they tweaking, and what the hell? Other times, I'm, like, just trying to let the kind of sound wash over me. And I do feel like that's what Odd-Tekker wants you to do. But I take issue with the point here of, like, what is the story they're trying to tell? I feel like Odd-Tekker doesn't want you to do that, right? So Andy also sent us, like, a narrative interpretation of Confield and Draft and said, Confield is like this spaceship full of aliens that are so indifferent to our human existence that if they wanted to, they could literally kill us right there and then with no remorse. Whereas Draft tells the story of an alien, or just some kind of creature that doesn't understand human emotion, finding their own sense of humanity. Every time a track on Draft feels emotive and human, it then gets deconstructed and destroyed as this alien doesn't understand how to process these human feelings they've never had before. You know, it's fun. It works. I love reading, you know, these kind of narrative interpretations like that. But I kind of feel like Odd-Tekker just wants you to think about, like, nothing but the sound. You know what I mean? Like, that's why they don't have, like, track titles or just give you anything to go by. They don't want to add that stuff to it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. We've talked about this a little bit before. You know, people have sent those sort of narrative ideas. And I mean, they're fun to read and fun to think about. But, you know, like I've said before, you know, I don't think that way. I never listen to a song or, you know, like an instrumental song and, like, come up with a story or anything. I'm much more like focus on, you know, the sound. I mean, even like he said, like with, you know, Musique Concrète, you're not supposed to, like, you know, you have to just turn your brain off a little bit or whatever, but and I agree that might be what they want you to do, but I don't know. What I love about all electronic music, early and current and everything, is, like, I like to, like, think about how those sounds were made and, you know, what they are and stuff. I just, like, really like dissecting things. I just like how things are made, you know, in general. So, you know, electronic music, like, lends itself to that so much for me that I really like to think of it in that way. And which I guess is just more of a, like, I guess rigid thinking than, you know, a narrative kind of thing, which my brain just doesn't work that way, I guess.
I mean, I kind of feel like I want to take the stronger position. Like, really, Odd-Tekker doesn't want you to do that. And, you know, I was thinking about this a lot, actually, because it's weird how music is the only art form where we do this. You know, like, imagine if you were looking at a painting and all you could think about was, like, the music it made you think of. Wouldn't that be, like, weird? The artist would be like, what the hell are you doing? Just look at it, you know, like experience it. Whereas we listen to instrumental music and all we can think about is, like, the pictures that it brings to your mind. Like, that's kind of bizarre. But I feel like Autechre really doesn't want you to do that. That's why they don't give you anything. They really just want you to like experience the sound like in the purest way possible. And I'm not like being critical, you know, to Andy or any other listener who sends us this stuff, because it really does kind of help me think about the music in different ways, which I'm hearing it. And honestly, I do it too, because it's weird that, you know, we have a podcast about Autechre and we're trying to turn it into words, which is itself is kind of a futile exercise. Honestly, I feel like if Autechre heard this podcast, they would hate it because they don't want you to do this. They want you to like literally just experience it like on a pure sound level, the way we like experience any other art form. But, you know, I understand like the need to kind of make sense of it with images and stories and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think there's like an intellectual need, you know, for those kind of things. There's like a famous Frank Zappa quote where he says, talking about music is like dancing about architecture. And it's like, yeah, that like on the surface that sounds good, but it's, I mean, people like have a need and a want to like discuss it, and it's music. You can't just discuss, you know, it's not especially instrumental music, you know, there's no words, so you have to like take something that is you know, wordless and change it to words. So however right. You do that, you know, like how we do with this podcast, or you know, people that write us in with the narratives, I think it's like sort of pretentious to say, oh no, you know, doing that's wrong or whatever. I don't mean what you said. Like, I think you're right. I think Autechre probably don't, you know, they themselves are not, you know, making a story. I just think like people in general, you know, like Zappa and stuff are being pretentious when they say things like that.
Yeah. I mean, it's true, because what we want to do is we want to like think, you know, we're going to think about it using concepts and stuff like that. But I appreciate Autechre's pursuit of like a post-concept listening experience.
Yeah.
You know, like, just pure experience, like don't intellectualize it. And ironically, I feel like the only way to actually accomplish that is by intellectualizing. I don't know. It's something like kind of paradoxical that I actually really like about Autechre. Move on to listener Jordan, who wrote, last episode, you talked a little bit about how you listen to Autechre's music. And I was thinking about the right and wrong ways of listening. I like that we got kind of like several emails on the same theme of like how to actually listen to Autechre. He says, I used to listen to Autechre the wrong way myself. So what is the wrong and right way? The wrong way just means listening in a setting that denies you the full experience, while the right way is like a serving suggestion for food. In my opinion, most of Autechre's music is nocturnal in nature, which means it is best to listen to them when it's dark outside. The wrong way of listening would be doing the opposite, or listening to them in the wrong environment. What would be worse than listening in the daytime at home would be listening in the daytime while walking, sitting on a bus, or being anywhere in public. What I would call the right way is listening at home while it's dark outside. If you want to go further than that, total darkness with no light at all. I would say the only three exceptions to this are Amber and Chiastic Slide, which don't sound too nocturnal, and Choristus, which is nocturnal but can be played casually on headphones or on a bus or bus stop. You would also need a good pair of speakers or headphones. It doesn't matter which, just don't use cheap rubbish. If you have shit audio, the music will just sound like beeps and mindless fart sounds, which means you don't hear the soul. What do you think? What is the right way to listen to Autechre?
You know, I don't know that I agree that there's a right or a wrong way. You know, I mean, and I think whichever way you enjoy more. I mean, because I basically do both of these things. I listen at night and stuff, which I would say I enjoy the most, but probably just because it's a, you know, a thing I like to do is, you know, lay down, listen to music and read and stuff. But I also listen all day at work too, like on a, you know, a little speaker, you know, not super loud or anything. Yeah, I have my own office, but you know, I don't want to be the weird guy, you know, beeping and booping in the background. Yeah. And I I feel like I'm not like coming to the music in like getting any less of a you know, experience in the music. I mean, I walk my dog, listen to Ottecker too, you know. I agree that like some records like have a nocturnal sense to them, or you know, a cold kind of thing. And I mean, there's certainly not even just Ottecker, like albums in general, you know, there's certain records that, you know, I'm sure are super nice to, you know, walk in the snow or something, you know, but that doesn't mean you can't, you know, like I live in Florida, it doesn't mean like I can't enjoy any, you know, snow themed record, you know. So I don't know, I don't think there's like a wrong or a right way. And when it comes to like, you know, the audio equipment you're using, like of course, like the you know, if you have nice stuff, it's you know, sounds better and stuff, but I think that's another, I've never gotten into like the super audiophile thing. I think it's sort of like another little kind of pretentious thing. You're like, just because somebody like, you know, either doesn't have access to or can't afford or whatever, like, you know, really good headphones, like you're excluded from being able to enjoy,
right,
you know,
right.
I just don't dig that, you know, kind of thing. I think like use the best that you can, you know, you have and whatever. I don't think like if you're listening on $30 headphones, you're going to hate Ottecker, but if you've got $200 headphones, you're going to love them. You know, I don't subscribe to that.
Yeah. I mean, the first point I want to make is that all music sounds better at night. That is one of my strongest held beliefs. It's just a fact. I don't know. Science needs to figure out why, but like at night, all music sounds better, period. That being said, I'm a big proponent, not just with Ottecker, but with like literally everything, of like the listening in multiple contexts, mm-hmm, kind of process. You know, one of the, I don't know, one of the least shitty things about the pandemic, obviously, but still a shitty thing, is that I don't get to, like, you know, I'm not out in the world like listening to Ottecker like while riding a bus or walking around, or, you know, you give some, I like to give some car listening. I like to do, you know, I've got like a, probably not audiophile, but like a nice setup at home, that I do most of my listening on. I've got some like nice headphones, but I also throw on the Apple, you know, AirPod things while I'm like washing the dishes or whatever. And I'm listening. And I feel like when you listen to music in a lot of different contexts, every context is going to kind of like bring something different out of it a little bit, you know. And it's not like you're going to discover, oh, like the absolute best place to listen to this track is like on the beach as the sun is setting or something like that.
Yeah,
it's just that like that moment in time, like that one fleeting moment when you were on the beach and you like had a couple margaritas and like you were feeling really good about things and the track hit you just right, you're gonna like probably discover something about the track that you'll then get to carry with you forever. It kind of goes back, honestly, to the question about drugs. Like, that's why I think that's cool, even though I don't do it. But it's like, if I could listen to it in different mind frames, you know, I don't think that's like the main mind frame that I would want to listen to it, but I would want to experience that just to hear it from a new perspective, you know?
No, I agree. I always try to listen to things, you know, in the car, you know, at home, at on speaker at work. I mean, shit, I'll listen, you know, mowing the grass, you know, with the, right, the lawnmower in the background, you know, kind of thing. I think you're right. You know, if something's only enjoyable in one, it would be like, you know, if there's a movie and that movie is only good if you in a theater, at home it sucks, then I think, right, you know, that movie probably just kind of sucks, you know, like if you can't, yeah, if it's not enjoyable in more than one, you know, like if you have to be in like the certain, you know, just perfect right spot, you know, like you said, the sun setting on the beach, you know, after you've had a margarita and a hat, like that's too specific. And it just, if that's, if you need all that, it just, don't waste your time, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there could be a favorite, like, for sure. There's
no. I mean, like, yeah, there's certainly, like, you know, the albums and stuff that I have like emotional ties to, in the sense that, like, you know, I was doing something, or and it sort of had that effect, you know, like,
or even just like, I like to listen to this on headphones, on nice headphones, most. Like, that's my favorite.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's movies that I like to see in the theater, but they're just,
right,
they're fine at home too, you know. It's that kind of thing. Yeah,
yeah. And you can have like a really nice experience, I think, listening to like Ottecker on the shittiest headphones on a bus or something, like it could hit you just right, and or you could hear somebody you never heard in it before. I think that's like totally valid. You want to read the next one?
Yeah, this is from listener Colin. It's a different Colin than the one earlier. Your commentary about abstract track titles had me realize something. All track titles from XI onwards begin with lowercase letters, with the exception of just a handful of tracks. I wonder why. Do you think this is purely a stylistic choice or indicative of a defined new phase of Autechre? Colin wrote again to add, actually, I stand corrected. The lowercase track titles started being mixed in during Charistus. Draft being in all caps is unique too. Still always interested me though. The return of a couple non-abstract titles, sign plus all end, is cool to see also.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like this is something we will have to return to as we move forward. But it is true actually that you start to get like a mix of kind of these lowercase titles, and by the time you get to like NTS, they're almost all lowercase and like fully not words, except for like the few exceptions that he mentioned here at the end. But I don't know. I know you're not one to like come up with these like grand theories, but do you have any, you know, guess at why?
They just seem like file names. And I think that most of the time when you're making a file name, do you ever capitalize, you know, them?
Right.
Some music I'm going to put in my phone or iPod or whatever, but like, you know, just like a file, Sean and Rob, you know, pass these things back and forth. I would just write in all, you know, lowercase letters too. And I think they just kind of maybe stick with it. I think at some point they basically do away with like actually titling the tracks, for the most part. And then, you know, just go with these file name type titles. I think that they just probably keep the capitalization they were using, as the all caps on Draft. I was thinking about that a little bit, like, because on Spotify they were all caps, and so I wasn't sure if, you know, that was just a mistake or whatever, but I looked it up. Yeah. And that is stranger, because it just seems odd to like write your you know, if it's a file name thing, it seems odd to like be doing it in caps but then in the future do it you know, lowercase.
Yeah.
I really don't have a guess as to why Draft is like that.
I mean, I think they kind of like shift. My understanding is that early tracks are kind of like inside jokes between Sean and Rob. You know, they're kind of like, you know, little like things that it's like a joke spin-off of a joke, spin-off of a joke or something. And it no longer means anything even to them, but it's just like became the track title. And then they start to transition into like the file name style of titling. So we're in this kind of like weird point where it's like sort of a half and half thing going on. And then, you know, by the time we get to like NTS and stuff and LSEC, it's like purely just file names. However, I do think it kind of goes back to what I was talking about earlier about like their endless pursuit of conceptless music listening. You know, like they, with like the cover art of Tri Repete and LP5 and like just a lot of the stuff they do, it's like they are, you know, removing anything that you could use to like attach this music to some picture or visual or something. You know, they really are like, I feel like throughout their career on just this endless quest for pure music experience. And I feel like kind of the pure file name, you know, things kind of fit in with that well. But again, I think it's something that we can sort of return to. I'll move on to listener Steve, who says, I always love the second disc of Tri Rep Plus Plus more. And in the process of listening to other releases and your podcasts, I find I keep comparing things to what they did on Anvil Vapor and Garbage. For example, I've been listening to Draft 730 a lot recently, and I think I appreciate it much more now than when it was first released. My favorite track may be Syrup Hair, which doesn't sound jammy to me, but sounds like a deliberate medley of different Autechre styles. It starts off with a deep bass and reverb percussion that sounds like a Shackleton track. The background percussion sounds like it could have been on Garbage, somewhat like the Broncos Even mix. Then at around 325 and especially 4 minutes, there are some record scratch like sounds that are reminiscent of Envane. The song then takes a turn and sounds much more like the rest of Draft 730. I mostly just wanted to read that part because we talked about this you know, a lot, and it's super weird how many little nods to like past Autechre sounds there seems to be, you know, like just hidden all over Draft. But I really want to discuss this second comment from Steve, where he says, I think the drum kit on V-Proc is very much like the beat on Uto. It's not meant to be sound design, but it serves as a juxtaposition for everything else that's happening in the song. It's a somewhat familiar structure that shows off the either otherworldly or constantly evolving sounds happening all around it. I wanted to get your take on this, because I defended the drums on Uto, which you were not such a fan of because of how normal they are. And then I criticized the drums on V-Proc. Am I being a hypocrite?
Yeah, probably. you know, I mean, maybe Uto, since it's earlier in the career, it's more, you know, forgivable. You know, I think really, like, coming off of Confield, which was so, like, sound design, you know, like not sounds of the world and stuff, and then to it is like sort of a regression to do something like that on V-Proc. So, you know, while it's maybe like slightly hypocritical, I think there's some reasoning behind it.
Yeah, I mean, in my defense, I would say that on Uto, the drums are taking the back seat so that you'll listen to that, like, just mammoth synth sound. Like, that's the thing you're supposed to focus on. And if the drums were too, like, interesting, you wouldn't be totally bowled over by it. Here, like, the up front and center lead spotlight stealing star of the show is this real drum kit. And that, to me, like, makes it very uninteresting in a way that Uto was not. That's my defense. I'm sticking to it. But I do really like the idea of just all these weird, like, references to earlier Autechre sounds. I guess we kind of speculated that, like, they weren't sure where to go, but I almost do like the idea of V-Proc as, like, a, you know, some sort of nod toward their approach on Uto. What's next?
Yeah, from Steve, he says, I strongly suggest that every fan's favorite period and style has a lot to do with which record they heard first and how old they were when they first heard it. I think Gabe mentioned that he first heard Charistus. I can't imagine that being someone's first exposure to Autechre. I think it would be interesting to hear what other fans' first exposure to Autechre was.
Yeah, I should clarify that Charistus was the first album that came out once I was an Autechre fan. So I heard, you know, Tri Rep first, and then did like Incunabula, LP5, Amber. You know, my only hang up with this theory is that it doesn't seem like probably 90% of people do that. Like, they go Tri Rep to Incunabula, LP5, and then they start branching forward.
Yeah, I feel, I mean, the first one I heard was Tri Rep and basically went that similar, you know, route, Amber and Incunabula, whatever, kind of thing. And while I love that era, it's not my favorite. I like the later stuff the most, and stuff. But, you know, I think that there's probably some truth to that. You know, I think if you maybe, I think it's safe to say that most people came in through Tri Repete. But, you know, say from Tri Repete, you for some reason, you know, moved on to the middle period. So, you know, maybe Draft came out, you know, right after you heard Tri Repete or something. So you went straight to that. I think, you know, you might have more of an affinity for that middle section that, you know, we've admitted that we sort of both struggle with and, you know, are currently struggling with a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'm willing to bet that a lot of people first got into Autechre with like XI because that was such a big deal when it came out. And I, you know, I would be curious. So basically I mostly wanted to read this because I do want to hear from people, like, what was your first Autechre album and how do you feel like that influenced, you know, what your favorite Autechre albums are, what your favorite period is. Would love to hear about that. All right. The last email here. I know this is a pretty long bonus episode, but our Christmas present to you for taking a week off. Listener James says, I would like to hear more discussion on historical and contextual occurrences with each release. It would transport the listener, if they are old enough or still have the neurons remaining, to remember when, where they were as the albums came out. Like, oh yeah, when this album came out, the Enron scandal was just breaking and Ludacris was lighting up the charts with Move, Bitch, Get Out the Way, or something like that. Of course, mixing the contextual American history with world events would appeal to a larger audience. You know, we've got some, we're like too young, I think, for the albums we've talked about to sort of remember like what was going on in great detail. But we heard from some listeners about like how, you know, Y2K influenced the way they listened to EP7 or like the, you know, the War on Terror influenced the way they listened to Gantz, Graf. I get the feeling you're not like a huge fan of doing this, though.
Maybe not with Autechre. You know, I do enjoy it. Like you know that Grateful Dead podcast where they go through all the dick's picks. You know, they always say like what the of the day of that show, you know, what was the you know, biggest movie in America, what was the top of the charts stuff. And that I like. It kind of gives you an interesting concept because like I feel like the Grateful Dead was like is much more of like a cultural you know, like American thing,
a huge part of American culture.
Yeah, Ottinger's like some things for nerds in their basements, you know, like you know, I don't. But also what you said too is true, like the records that we've talked about so far, like we just weren't really old enough, you know, we weren't listening to them when they came out. You know, in 1999 I would have been like 11 or 12 depending on the month. You know, I don't know what, you know, what was going on in the world mostly. Yeah, so I like it on certain things, you know, a cultural aspect. You know, I read a lot of history and stuff, and I do really like to know, you know, the kind of bigger picture of things like that. But everything here either seems too recent or just like not enough of like mainstream culture to matter, you know?
I mean, we're getting to the point now where we will remember what was going on. So maybe we can try to bring it in a little bit. But I was like kind of testing it with Draft and like looking up like what was going on in 2003. And it's like, okay, like the U.S. invaded Iraq like around the time the Draft came out. 50 Cent was like killing it on the Billboard charts around the time the Draft came out. And it's like, I read that and I'm like, I don't know what to do with that information. Like, I don't know. Like,
yeah, same.
Does it tell me anything about Ottinger? I don't know.
Same. Like, I mean, in 2003, like I remember that we went to war with Iraq, but I was a young kid and it didn't like mean anything to me. You know what I mean? It was just like something that was on TV sometimes and everything. And same. And even at that age, like I didn't listen to, you know, 50 Cent or anything. Like, I was probably into Slipknot or something, you know, that we're not going to talk about. So, it's really like, honestly, I think like like I said, I like history. I read history and stuff, but I really do feel like the late 90s to 2000 is kind of what I know the least about.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just weird. I just don't know like what Ottinger fans, because, you know, I guess it's an overgeneralization, but I'm willing to bet that most people who are obsessed with Ottinger were not the people who were like really into 50 Cent in 2003.
Yeah, probably.
I liked it because I was like really young and just watching TRL every day and didn't know who Ottinger were. But, you know, it's like, I can't say that if I can't imagine that if I was old enough at that time, I would be like, every time I heard 50 Cent, I would think about, well, what does this mean for Ottinger's Draft? You know, or like, and then, okay, you could say like, all right, 9/11 or like the war in Iraq, like these are like huge, huge things. So probably they were on a lot of people's minds while they were listening to these albums for the first time. But then there's other stuff that like gets a lot more like tenuous, you know? I'm like thinking like, okay, so like everybody who was listening to like LP5 was probably thinking about the Monica Lewinsky scandal. I couldn't stop thinking about it while they were listening to that. You know, I don't fully know what to do with it, but we'll see. We could test it out. We'll see. All right, just to wrap it up, I want to shout out Jeff, Joe, Eric, and probably a few others I'm missing for sending and recommending a bunch of Ottinger bootlegs as we requested. We are really enjoying them. But that's it for this massive bonus episode.
All right. If you've got any Ottinger opinions, hot takes you want to share, we want to hear them. gonkcastpod@gmail.com. Next episode, less than a week, Untilted. Again, send us your thoughts, gonkcastpod@gmail.com. If you like the show, help us out. Subscribe. Leave us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcast. Look us up on YouTube. Stay connected. Twitter, Instagram. Both of those are @gonkcastpod. And we'll see you next time.
See ya.